Hadi bakalım.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction, your weekly source for independent commentary on cultural news and politics, where it's always our mission to arm you with the tools you need to cut through media misdirection and resist the mono narrative. I am joined by my friend, David Rand. How are you, sir?
Good, man. How you doing?
Excellent. Doing very well. Got off of a fishing trip. That's why I have a tan line from here down.
Nice.
If you could tell behind my gorgeous blue light blocking glasses. We are also pleased to be joined by a longtime friend of the show, founder of Beefy Media, citizen scientist, trained microbiologist, serial failed entrepreneur, and our good friend, John Griffith. How are you, sir?
Never better. Thanks for asking, bud.
Fantastic. Griff, by the way, did write all of those things for us to say, so it's not my words, they're his. Griff, so we brought you in today because you are somewhat of a, I put it as biohacker, but you eschewed that term. You prefer citizen scientist. We've got a lot of conversation going on right now in the zeitgeist about health and wellness, and especially with the MAHA movement and RFK Jr. and all the things that are happening around that. So we want to dig in on some of those topics. I guess let's start with the origins of kind of where MAHA came from, because I think for a lot of people, it just exploded onto the scene. And all of a sudden, it was a talking point. Chronic disease was something to be reckoned with, but it's been an issue for a long time, hasn't it?
Absolutely. You can trace it all the way back to, really the beginning, 1900, 1910, when the Flexner Report came out, which was funded by Andrew Carnegie, and basically began to set the tone for what medical education would look like. So obviously these are the people that are training the, current and future practitioners that are then disseminating the information to all of the patients. They've built up a lot of trust. And so, we need to kind of start looking at how that system was built. And what the Flexner Report did was effectively put the kibosh on any type of medicine that was considered homeopathic, traditional, and focused its efforts on that which could be treated through pharmaceuticals. So that was, in my eyes, a major turning point to where we began to eschew traditionalist methods and started really digging into what would ultimately generate this massive pharma complex that I think has been top of mind for everybody lately.
Absolutely. And there are elements of that too within food since then, right? Like there were studies that were funded by, similarly perhaps mal-incentivized individuals to demonize things like saturated fat or, in favor of low-fat diet, elevating sugar or saying sugar's not so bad. Like what were some of those interstitial points in that timeline?
Well, so right around that same time, early 1900s, Procter and Gamble began hydrating liquid from cottonseed production. And that resulted in this very stable fat. It was marketed to Jewish families as a kosher alternative to things like lard and tallow. Really, this was a byproduct of, an industrial lubricant that was obviously really important during the Industrial Revolution. And they were able to figure out a way to kind of, increase the value of what was typically a waste product from cotton seeds. So that was framed around this idea that this fat was better for you than these other ones. And that was kind of overlapping with the time. You can kind of fast forward a couple years to the 50s when Eisenhower had a heart attack. And that sort of brought the idea that the diet was related somehow to disease. It wasn't really top of mind for a lot of people up until that point. Where you began to see this medical establishment really cement its long-term influence over the health of the country was this guy Ansel Keys, who was a epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota and a incredible orator, his grasp of persuasive techniques was, you know, top notch. And so he was able to kind of finagle his way into the administration, and ultimately began setting the tone for what would become health policy surrounding fats and sugars. So his hypothesis was that, saturated fats specifically were the cause of heart disease. You had some competing entities across the pond, and a guy named John Yudkin, whose thesis was that sugar was causing the main problem. The sugar argument was problematic because at that same time you had a burgeoning domestic sugar industry that was beginning to, you know, really again like also have great economic incentives associated with it.
Interesting. So seed oils were a byproduct of engine lubricant and somehow became passable as a food product. How does that happen?
Well, so what the idea was that these seed oils could, based on their conformation, and we'll call them, I mean, seed oils is sort of a modern term. You know, I like industrial fats, industrial lubricants.
Sounds much more gross when you say it.
yeah, definitely. It's a little more sticky. So the idea was that these fats would essentially lower what was termed bad cholesterol, because they had not a nuanced understanding of cholesterol at all. So they were seeing in some small scale trials that certain, and these weren't even trials, these were observations, epidemiologic observations. They were seeing that certain geographical regions had experienced less heart disease than others. And these regions tended to use things like olive oil or, you know, these polyunsaturated fats versus the traditional saturated fats that we were using.
Interesting. And so what is the reason why seed oils are deemed to be so bad for human health now? It's got something to do with high levels of omega-6 fatty acids versus omega-3s. Is that right?
Kind of, sort of. So you have to look at the chemical conformation. So a saturated fat it's basically a string of carbons, and it has these hydrogen atoms all around it. That makes it less reactive and very stable at room temperature. That's why it's not a liquid. So the unsaturated fats have these highly reactive double bonds, and those double bonds, when they are ingested and brought into the cell membrane, can cause oxidation, which sort of leads to dysfunctional cellular communication.
And then so in layman's terms, what exactly does that mean?
It means that the polyunsaturated fats have the propensity to cause inflammation higher than the saturated fats do.
Gotcha. And so obviously these have become, seed oils specifically, or industrial lubricants rather, have become a target of sort of the, I would say, the peripheral MAHA red pill movement as like a real contributor to this chronic disease epidemic that we're hoping to solve. So do you agree with that? Are they a primary driver? Or are they just one component of what's going on here? What's your take on that?
I think that they're a large component of it. I think that they probably have a lot to do with why we are seeing, at the very least, increased obesity over the last 50 to 60 years. Because when you look at the statistics, and this is pulled from USDA, you know, the average per capita consumption of soybean, corn, and canola oil is about 91 pounds per person in the United States.
Wow. Wow.
And if you break that out into total calories on an annual basis, it's about 370,000 calories. Based on a recommended daily allowance of 2,000 calories, that equals about half of what you would need in a year, just based on that 2,000 calorie mark. If you're to take that a step further and look at how that might contribute to excess adiposity, weight gain, you're looking at potentially 100 extra pounds per year. And so obviously, like, you know, you have to take into account that that's not going to be every single individual is consuming that much. But given that number, you can, it's not much of a stretch to see why each consecutive year you would see more and more weight gain associated with consuming that much extra fat.
Yeah. So obviously if you were to just replace that fat with tallow, you'd still be consuming excess calories. So that wouldn't necessarily, contribute to a weight loss per se, but it would ostensibly be better for you with a more stable fat.
Potentially, there's several buckets when it comes to how we utilize energy. So you have the energy balance model, which is kind of the calories in, calories out, that a lot of people subscribe to. You have a carbohydrate insulin model, which is basically how you manage the utilization of glucose. You know, either you're utilizing glucose for fuel or it can be shuttled off and stored as fat. So depending on the rest of your macronutrient intake, you're going to, potentially see deleterious effects. And if you're adding these inflammatory molecules into your system, it just kind of exacerbates the whole situation. And then when you consider that most of these products are packaged alongside excess sugar, refined carbohydrates, you kind of have this milieu of disaster in the diet. The health aspect of it is, it's pretty solid. I think like when you start to break down the financial incentives associated with it, that's when it becomes even more nefarious, because it's just kind of this perverse incentive that, was set in place really in the 70s when they were trying to figure out how to use all this excess corn that they were producing. And so they figured out ways to subsidize the excess production of things like corn, soybean, and then wound up, paying farmers to produce more of this oil. Well, they then had to figure out what they're going to do with this oil. So it's just this loop that it doesn't really incentivize the macroeconomic situation to really care about the health of the consumers.
So especially when you combine it with the food pyramid model of what you're supposed to eat in a day of 6 to 11 servings of grain on top of all those fats, seed oil fats or industrial lubricant fats.
Yes.
Then you're sitting at an enormous amount of total calories in a day, even if you're going on the balance model, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's like a bit of a misconception that, dietary fat causes, weight gain. It doesn't. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of seems so simple like that. And it doesn't exactly work like that. I mean, really, when it comes to the calories you should be getting from good fats, it's not too far away from 50% of your calories.
Well, it also works with the whole like perverse incentive question, right? So you have farm subsidies that get kicked in a big way, in the 1930s and 40s. Then we designed the food pyramid, probably based upon influence from the agricultural lobby, putting 6 to 11 servings a day at the bottom of that pyramid. That goes all the way till 2011.
Wow. And then they introduced MyPlate, right?
Right. Right.
And is that any better?
I'm not sure. Is it any better? I mean, I was educated on the food pyramid, and it was about 2011. I discovered that the food pyramid was bullshit. So therefore
it's an Illuminati construct, obviously. It's a pyramid.
The symbolism. So we had RFK Jr. Get some delicious tallow fries. I want to get your reaction to this, Griff. Fox News. Well, hold on.
By the way, here you go. Here's this. Take the red mask. I'll take those trays for you.
Okay? Oh, okay. Is that... this is me? Okay, thank you.
Secretary, this is for you.
He looks so unhappy.
You didn't forget my Coke, did you?
Huh? Get your Coke?
I got it. Miss Small, with the little ice. But I'm not going to drink it all because he's going to yell at me. I'm only kidding.
And Steak and Shake just switched out, and people are raving about these French fries. You taste them.
They're amazing. They really are.
When I was a kid, I travel in Europe. The Europe is great, always had great food. The French fries were always a disappointment because we had the best French fries here. They had pommes frites over there, and they just didn't taste right. Today, the best French fries in the world are in Europe. I order them every time I go to Belgium or France or any place else. And the French fries here just don't taste right. And you taste these, it's a completely different experience. And the customers are raving about it. Other companies, Steak and Shake, has been great. We're very grateful for them, for RFK, the French fries turned me into a verb. But also Popeyes.
By the way, a plastic straw. Thank you. Stand those paper straws. I hate them.
Hitting the heavy policy points.
You know, so I noticed that, I mean, it looked like about half his plate was French fries. Mm-hmm. French fries are classified as a vegetable, right? By the my plate perspective. So, you know, he's following the guidelines there.
Okay, so what's your take here? Are tallow fries really better than seed oil fries?
I mean, I have no doubt that they taste delicious. There's zero question there. What I think is unfortunately happening here is, you know, what we've coined tallow valoring. So it's become, you know, I mean, tallow is basically a brand now. And, you know, it assigns you to a tribe of sorts. And so you're seeing all these companies adopt it. I mean, some of these companies like Popeyes has been using tallow to fry their chicken as part of their, you know, their commitment to Louisiana cooking traditions. So they've just now started to announce it. Now their tallow has some anti-foaming agents in it. You know, it has some dubious additives that, you know, keep it stable or keep it liquid or keep it preventing from foaming over in the fryer. The Steak and Shake fries, like while they may be fried in tallow, it's my understanding that, and you can't, it's really difficult to actually find when you look on Steak and Shake's website and look at the ingredients. It doesn't really break down the ingredients. There's a little asterisk on the French. It basically says tallow, salt, and French fries with an asterisk. And, you know, the only indication of any additive is that asterisk says contains soy. You're not going to be able to find this on their website, but various outlets have reported that these fries come what's called parboiled. So whoever's manufacturing these fries in large quantities is kind of pre-cooking these fries in soybean oil and various other additives. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see, you know, a turnaround in the health of America because of this use of tallow. You know, I mean, is it a net positive overall? You know, possibly. I mean, it's going to, if it serves as a conduit or a gateway for people to begin, you know, digging into where their food comes from, and maybe they start to follow down that old grass-fed pathway, they look into regenerative ag, you know, maybe there's that's a few steps removed, but that's one possibility. Mm-hmm. But to think that, you know, all of your woes are going to be cured from eating tallow fries is, you know, probably a bit naive.
Yeah. So if you look at my plate, it's a 20-20-30 a breakdown, right? So, and that would kind of, if you look at his plate, right, it's vegetables, which obviously, you know, potatoes are vegetables now, I guess. Fruits, grains, and then 20% and 30% grains still.
Wow.
Out of that. And then 20% protein.
So
dairy.
Yeah. So I think that what that establishes is that there's still a lot of sort of incentive within the system, these entrenched interests that are still wielding influence over the supposedly ideal American diet, by way of my plate, I would assume. And also, yeah. I mean, with the degree that you're talking about the fries, Griff, you know, yeah, using tallow is at least symbolically important, I think, because maybe it elevates the conversation around, well, what fat is my food fried in if I'm eating fried food? But then it does mandate that people look deeper into it. And now, obviously, as you mentioned, the parboiling, we have to now look one step up the supply chain to see, well, what fat are they using? And then you probably want to look a step further, like, well, what are the potatoes drenched in on the in the field, you know, in terms of pesticide or herbicide or whatever. So, I mean, like, there's what we want to see is this opening of a conversation around the entire value chain of our food supply, and not just check the box. They're using tallow now. They're the good guys. Only go to Steak and Shake and screw the rest, because that's just gonna that's gonna result in us getting sort of the least possible good outcome from something that could be potentially really valuable at getting people to really more deeply consider their food.
We should use the Second Amendment model when it comes to diet, right?
What's that?
Right. So the government's not going to show up 5 minutes later and tell you what to eat, and you're going to get healthy, right? It's right. up to every individual to protect themselves from being unhealthy, right? And if we take that model and encourage that model, I think we're in a much better place. Assuming like it's better to have a healthy recommendation, for sure. I could see that argument, right? We need to get rid of the food pyramid, get rid of My Plate, whatever, and replace it with maybe something better. But when it comes to those questions, like they're only going to go there if they realize that they're responsible. And that's really the perverse incentive to these structures of government taking ownership over making people healthy.
Right.
At the end of the day, is that, you know, until we get a culture that says, no, you're responsible for your health. You can't blame anyone else. You can't offset the costs of the, of your health to anybody else. People aren't going to do that.
How, go ahead, Griff.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great segue into comparing how our food system, how, you know, the FDA approves a food ingredient versus how it's done in the EU. You know, so over here, it's basically they look at it on a spectrum of risk. They look at what the probability of a negative outcome occurring is. Whereas in the EU, when it comes to food safety, you know, they look at it's pretty binary. It's yes or no. Like, will this cause a problem? If it does, they err on the side of caution. You know, we tend to just look at it more of a probability standpoint, and that is turning out to not really work out for us.
Well, I'm curious what you guys think about this. I mean, it seems like the same economic incentives would exist in America as exist in Europe, but somehow they take a different approach than the United States, which is very much more open about allowing these ingredients that are generally regarded as safe to be added to food. Why is that?
Yeah. So I wouldn't describe the status quo as what we do is we're freedom orientated, and therefore we wound up with an obesity epidemic. I think we're a corporatist structure that encourages people to eat terrible and then offset the cost to other people. Europe is defined by all healthcare expenditures are offset to other people. It's all universal healthcare out there. And therefore, the precautionary principle exists. And they apply that to everything. They apply that to online speech. They apply that to AI. They apply it to all emerging technologies, crypto, all that kind of stuff. So when it comes to innovation, we're more permissive, but we're also incredibly, you know, corporately influenced and corporatist in our structure. Therefore, I would just differentiate those two things. I don't mind the freedom, but I want the freedom without the food pyramid, you know, and all right. the bullshit that goes along with it.
Yeah,
that's such an interesting thing to wrestle with in your head philosophically, you know, with this precautionary principle of kind of defaulting to, you know, if nature has a better way of doing it, then go with that way. But then you run the risk of this, you know, appeal to nature fallacy, where, and so you're constantly, you know, wondering which way is the right way.
Right. Well, RFK Jr. is not only eating tallow fries; he's also apparently, he's popping nicotine pouches at his confirmation hearing, and very interestingly, taking methylene blue in his water on an airplane. So, Griff, I want your take on methylene blue, which is now just starting to kind of reach more people in terms of its potential use for them. We'll take a look at this clip here really quick.
It's a real quick one. You just talk over it. But yeah, here he is. He's dropping in the blue into his water there. Taking two good long dips there. I mean, it's already blue, bro. Like, what do you need the second one for?
Okay, so
I find it, you know, quite contradictory that the man pushing to remove food dyes from the food system is guzzling this coal tar derivative.
But that's a naturalist fallacy, right?
Yeah, I suppose. So methylene blue certainly has use cases.
First of all, what is it before we start into what it's used for?
So it's a dye. It's typically been used for staining slides for histology sake, you know, for basically like visualizing tissue under a microscope. They use it during surgical procedures to, you know, to kind of illuminate vasculature, you know, to see if a compound is making it to a tissue. And it's also been used therapeutically for traumatic brain injuries. Hmm. You know, it's an MAOI inhibitor. So it can have some antidepressant effects. It's my understanding that it can also potentially, if abused, lead to the serotonin syndrome, where you're producing too much serotonin, potentially has some pretty negative downstream effects. So, you know, to me, it's the kind of thing that is not something that everybody should just be willy-nilly messing around with in terms of ingesting it. And I just saw a paper, it just came out recently, that was looking at how this dye can long-term stain tissues and what its like tissue tropism is, like where it preferentially will go. And it lasts a very long time in heart and brain tissue. And what the long-term effects are of that, it's kind of unknown.
Well, it's really easy. He just wants his brain worm to live in a blue space, right? Yeah. Right. He's just trying to redecorate for his brain worm. I'm moving it over to our website just so we don't have to look at RFK doing drops.
Nice.
Yeah.
I found it to be, you know, I've been experimenting with it. And I like it topically. You know, it does have some characteristics that would suggest that it's neatly coupled with red light therapy. So there's an absorption band that methylene blue exhibits right in the red light spectrum. And so in theory, using red light topically can increase blood flow to a certain area and reduce blood pressure, which can reduce for my purposes, I put it on my knees, and I can absolutely feel those effects for recovery purposes. And while it's on there, so I'm experimenting with it in that regard. And so far, my experience has been nothing but positive. I did, of course, drink the Kool-Aid when first started entering the cultural zeitgeist, and I did not like the way it made me feel. The first couple days maybe seemed like there was, you know, some sort of energetic effect, but it made me ultimately feel kind of depressed. Hmm. That's my experience. People's mileage may vary, and some people swear by it. And so, you know, I know there's a UFC fighter that's marketing a product. He's probably, you know, has been just riddled with TBIs over the years. And I think it's probably working really well for him. And for some people, probably does have a great therapeutic benefit. But for everybody, I mean, not for me.
Well, I have a question for you, because I'm sure a lot of people are going to be swayed a little bit by the influencers out there. Some of the trusted voices who are speaking very highly of it. But obviously, like you say, everyone is different. It's not going to work the same for everyone. So how is a person supposed to go out and find accurate information around how it would work for them? What kind of doctor would someone go to if they're like, I want to try this under some supervision, with the understanding that, you know, I'm going to have a trained guide here with me while I experiment in this way?
Well, with methylene blue, it's probably a neurosurgeon, you know, somebody who's actually used it in surgical procedures over the years, you know, both pre and post op. So, I mean, that would probably be the safest way. I think mostly you see like chiropractors, pushing it, functional medicine doctors. I think your general practitioners are probably going to shy away from it. That's a conversation that I think ultimately, with something like that, that has such potential to have negative outcomes, you know, you really do need to be under the guidance of a physician who's trained in its use. RFK probably has, you know, consultants on that in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I ask is because you would think that okay, so if methylene blue hasn't historically been used for, let's say, like one of the reasons that people seem to be taking it is for its cognitive benefits, makes you more alert, sharper, you know, can improve memory and things like that, allegedly, right? A trained, you know, Western medicine trained doctor might not be the person to go to because they're going to be relying on their Western medical training more or less to say, oh, no, it's not for that or whatever. It just seems like there's a degree of reluctance to step outside the mold that they were formed in. And that makes total sense to me. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with, you know, taking precaution that way. But do you think that a standard, you know, Western medical doctor is going to look at some of these alternative things that are popping up with any degree of, you know, positivity towards their potential benefits? Or are they just going to be like, no, don't do it. It's not the pharmaceutical model that I understand. I'm not going to recommend it.
There seem to be an interesting crop of new physicians coming out that do put a lot more faith in anecdotal evidence than you know, what has traditionally been you know, deferred to for like evidence-based medicine. So yeah, I mean, I think you're going to start to see more and more doctors willing to try these things if they can establish that they're doing no harm. I know, I mean, that's kind of it's just like the baseline determinant. So yeah, I mean, I mean
they recommended the COVID jab. How'd that go for them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, many did, not all. They, I mean, right. You gotta be careful with that.
Fair. I'm not trying to throw
fallacy, Joe. Come on.
Hey, relax. I'm not trying to throw all doctors under the bus on that, but I'm just saying.
No, I think that's
understanding of do no harm is a little bit different now, I think, post-COVID than people thought of it prior to that.
People are rightfully skeptical.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's, you know, another, when you look at kind of the dissenting opinions on that particular topic, you know, you had folks like Jay Bhattacharya, who was quite vocal. And, you know, a lot of these folks have all the credentials, all the publications, you know, prior to their stance, you know, in those couple of years were generally lauded as you know, high professionals in their field. And so to see, you know, a nominee for the NIH like Jay Bhattacharya, has he been confirmed?
I don't know. I haven't heard.
I just looked it
positively
up.
Yet, but.
No, not yet, as of March 11th. But he's currently Monica M. Bernatogli. Yeah.
No idea who that is.
Yeah. But no, he's Senate confirmation has not been done yet.
Gotcha. Right. So what I mean, you know, with folks like that and what the big shift here is that, you know, we've set up this system whereby, you know, academia has essentially acted as a mouthpiece for industry and government edicts. And it's at the expense of the, you know, the patients, the consumers having full informed consent on what they're ingesting. And so, you know, I think like some of the positive things that could come out of the MAHA movement, when you have folks like Bhattacharya and Marty McCary, who did stand pretty firm, you know, as dissenting opinions throughout all that nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. Generally speaking, MAHA wise, I mean, how are you feeling about sort of the promises that were run on, I want to say, but the promises that were fielded early on versus kind of some of the effects or the outcomes that you're seeing right now?
Cautiously optimistic. You know, I it's cool to see so much stuff happening so quickly. You know, from that standpoint, it's like, it's just interesting to watch the cultural shifts that are occurring. You know, people that were very pro MAHA are already starting to kind of bail because they're not happy with some of the appointments, whether it's, you know, the head of the USDA or, you know, there's still a lot of questions. We don't know what the, you know, the 2025 dietary guidelines are going to look like. I think that's going to be a major milestone in determining how, you know, what the intentions of this administration really are. So, I mean, yeah, like I said, I'm stoked about a couple of those folks, Bhattacharya, McCary. Right now, you know, just approaching with caution.
Yeah, I think we have this expectation from Doge that things are supposed to move as fast as that, but everything else is moving at the speed of government, right?
Yeah.
So in political terms, he just got started, right?
For sure.
Yeah, one Steak Shack media appearance is actually pretty good in political terms. But,
true.
But yeah. Everything else kind of got spoiled. We do have, for example, 83% of USAID programs being cut. That was Marco Rubio today. But that's quick, right? That's Doge inspired, right? They're not going to get into, I assume, food recommendations from Doge point of view, right?
Yeah, perhaps not as much of a, well, all the priority for them.
All the speed is coming through EOs and Doge, right? So, yeah, it'll take time.
And as we're seeing things, like the continuing resolution are, you know, going to be very contentious when it comes to the legislative process.
Talk about that on the other show.
Yeah. We will. You mentioned, Griff, red light therapy, and that's kind of burst onto the scene as well lately in the alternative health space. What is that? Why are people doing it? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, yeah, I mean, while it is top of mind right now, it's certainly not a novel concept. And really, like the original seed oil disrespecter is this guy, Ray Pete, who, have you heard of Ray Pete?
I have not.
No.
So he was, he got his PhD in biology, I think from Oregon. He was actually a professor at MSU for a period of time.
Go Bobcats.
Yeah, totally. He was, very strong proponent of a low PUFA, low polyunsaturated fat diet, strong proponent of heliotherapy, therapy from the sun, very encouraging of red light. Interestingly, also, he was, very much not aligned with kind of like current keto principles. You know, he was all about lots of orange juice, lots of honey. So there's a whole new segment of like kind of these primal dieters who are kind of referred to as petists, that like honey max, orange max, like, you know, just fruit before noon, no limits on the consumption. But utilizing light therapy as a way to, kind of deal with the added intake of carbohydrates. So red light's really cool for a number of reasons. So red light, when it comes to processing carbohydrates, it's been shown, there's been some fairly robust studies that red light positioned, 6 inches from the body can basically, it can increase glucose metabolism significantly. So a lot of folks who, are potentially, diabetic, pre-diabetic, have difficulty metabolizing glucose, have insulin issues, are finding that red light therapy can be very helpful with that. And if you kind of take it to a broader spectrum, like where maybe you're not having any problems, but you're particularly interested in this citizen science approach of, partitioning your nutrients and utilizing some of these natural elements, red light's very effective. Some people say that if you're going to eat junk food, you might as well do it outside where your body is more primed to handle it. Because during, if you look at the spectrum of sunlight, it's all of the colors. So, it's big blue right here, a small dip, and then it basically like turns into red, and you've got this entire spectrum. And so that red light is very crucial for our biological processes. And now they've figured out that specific targeting in certain areas can do wonders for recovery from soft tissue damage. It's shown to promote fat loss. It has a lot of pretty well-defined clinical outcomes. And so, yeah, it's become sort of du jour, I think, along with kind of like the sauna culture, the increased awareness of what heat and light can do, because, red light on the far end of the spectrum, that's heat, it's when we're all emitting it. It's like why we all are basically, just filled with these light emitting cells. That's how we communicate. We have these chromophores that are essentially these colored proteins that act as signaling channels throughout our body. It's why, you know, your liver is this nice blue purple color, your heart's this vibrant red color, you know, all of these colors act as communication channels. So now it's just, we're figuring out ways to actually utilize it in clinical environments. And it's quite effective.
That's fascinating. And it kind of ties in with the opposite end of the spectrum, which you did mention, the blue light piece, which obviously we're wearing these very stylish blue light blocking glasses. Griff, yours look cool. I really like them. What's the correlation there between the blue light blocking glasses and red light therapy? Why is blue light now persona non grata and red light is all the rage?
So when we look at, again, when we go outside, like blue light is not necessarily the enemy, because, you know, it's always been there, but in nature, blue light is always accompanied by an abundance of every other color on the spectrum. And so when you look at the times of day, you'll see blue light is very prevalent during sunrise and sunset. During those hours, like, yeah, there's a little bit of red light scattered in, but those blue light is kind of like a signaling molecule. It's a way to tell your body that it's time to get up or to lay down. Now what's happened with the rise of LEDs, and this was like in, you know, 2007, they basically made incandescent bulbs illegal, more or less. And so incandescent bulbs exhibit this really nice, consistent light spectrum, basically starts down here with just a tiny, tiny bit of blue and just works its way up like this. CFLs, you know, compact fluorescents, have these very prominent spikes of blue. And then the LEDs that we see are pretty heavily associated with blue. And so what's going on is we want to see blue first thing in the morning or right at sunset. And that's why, like, when you go out, you know, during those times, the sky is pretty blue, like, you know, pretty consistently. But like when you start to see blue light after dark, that signals to your body. So what you're looking to do is, you know, blue light essentially signals your body to stop producing melatonin. You know, there's some pathways in between all of that, but just for the sake of argument, like that's what it's doing. So, you know, in the morning, you obviously want to stop the production of melatonin, increase cortisol, wake up, get going. In the evening, you want to be ideally bathed in no light. Maybe some, you know, the people before us were around fire, which does emit like a little bit, but what's happening is that blue light is essentially causing it's very energy efficient, because these incandescent bulbs emit a lot of heat. So, you know, in the name of energy efficiency, we're kind of causing an energy crisis in the human body by sort of flipping, distorting our standard circadian rhythm, if that tracks.
That totally does. And I mean, it makes a lot of sense too. We're all, you know, surrounded by screens, which also emit blue light, right? If you're looking at your phone before you go to bed, or your computer, or you're watching a movie on your TV, you're getting a ton of blue light, which is disrupting your circadian rhythm. And of course, it tracks that a lot of people complain about not sleeping very well, but we're all staring at screens up until the moment that we turn on our alarm and go to bed. So it does kind of correlate, I would think, that is probably not a positive influence for good sleep. Have you noticed like any difference with regard to your wearing red light glasses or avoiding blue light in your house prior to bed? Has that helped with your sleep patterns?
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, it's 100%. And it's, again, it's one of those, it's sort of like, you know, when you're trying to optimize, you're trying to get those few extra percentage points, you know, and these, no doubt about it, make a massive difference for me personally and for a lot of other people that use them. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's kind of, you get some funny looks for it. But I kind of refer to it as like trying to prevent social jet lag. You know, like I'll wear them out, like when if you've got a social event at night, you know, they're very nice to kind of calm yourself down a little bit. Yeah, for me, they've been a game changer with regards to my sleep.
Yeah. Personally, in the Mark Andreessen category, I think, you know, it's a mark of manliness about how late you can stare at a computer screen and go right to bed.
Yeah.
See, anti-Huberman position.
The anti-Huberman position. I mean, that was the sort of modus operandi of entrepreneurs for the better part of the entire time that we were working together, Griff. I mean, in my early 20s, it was like, how late can I stay up, sleep under my desk, and then how early can I get up the next day to keep working because yeah. I have to work all hours of the day or I'm not being productive.
Yeah, I'm kidding. No, but there
well,
it is. Yeah.
Well, and you know, there's like some, you know, deeper conspiratorial ideas behind the rise of blue light. And some of it, I mean, this is well documented in the patents for, you know, some of these screens that we're staring at all the time. I mean, we know that these blue lights, they can kind of put us into a bit of a catatonic state. They can absolutely cause us to become addicted to these things that we stare at. There's no doubt about it that there's increased dopamine that, you know, that we, you know, that we get from staring at these blue screens, but it's like, there's only, but so much of that that you can digest until you've got a massive problem. And it's like, these lights, I mean, when you look at like compact fluorescence, I mean, these things were really meant to, you know, be utilized in circumstances where you've got, you know, groups of men, children, you know, whether these are people that you're grooming for the army or, you know, young kids in school sitting under compact fluorescence, it pacifies those people and puts them into this just kind of like, you know, dopaminergic state.
Yeah. One of the complaints at the time of the 2000s was that one of the big reasons why the old school lights incandescents went away and compact fluorescence were pushed is because of energy requirements, efficiency requirements. And then LEDs came along and they didn't even need the requirement. They just wiped everything out because they're so energy efficient.
Right. But can't you make LEDs? Don't a lot of the red lights, you know, systems that are out there use LEDs to generate red and near infrared light?
Yes, but what they're doing is they're limiting the flicker, so you can't really see it. But if you're to like just film, like if you're to take out your iPhone and film on slow mo, an LED light, you'll see it. You'll see this yep. fast flicker. Yep. And that's something that like you don't see with the naked eye, but it's causing all kinds of dysfunction when it comes to, you know, these hormonal signalings. I mean, light like kind of is a hormone. You know, we have basically this considered like a root ball of nerves all throughout our eyeball. And so like, you know, peripheral right through the center, you know, there's all these little receptors that do a lot more than just help you, you know, see. They actually wind up, you know, causing a cascade of hormonal signaling that, you know, when it's dysfunctional, can lead to, you know, diabetes, can lead to obviously disrupted sleep patterns. I mean, there's been plenty of observational studies looking at, you know, shift workers, nurses, like ER docs. You know, there's I think one of the most famous ones is looking at, you know, nurses that work overnight had higher incidence of breast cancer than their daytime working, you know, colleagues. So there's, and I mean, there's, they looked at, shift workers working under compact fluorescence and compared them to smokers and found that the light at night was actually worse, you know, had like a higher increased incidence of cancers than even smoking did. So, wow. You know, again, these weren't like necessarily cause and effect. But you know, if it was causing it, that's what it would look like.
The correlations look the same.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. So, and I think, you know, this is important to note for people, like if you don't want to go out and buy blue light blocking glasses or replace all the LED bulbs in your house, cause a lot of them now are like the, you know, these singular piece PAR cans that just drop in place of where you would previously have an incandescent. What can people do to like get the, you know, the 80-20 benefit of red light or less blue light without breaking the bank?
So like probably the easiest thing is you can mitigate the effects of blue light at night by getting plenty of time outside during the day, particularly in that midday range when UVB is at its highest. So if you can spend a couple, 30 minutes, an hour, as much time as you can outside during the day without sunglasses. You know, sunglasses are, I kind of joke and call them condoms for your eyeballs. they distort light, and these spectrums, these wavelengths are, precisely engineered by God or whoever to help us, achieve our normal physiologic processes. So when you're wearing sunglasses all throughout the day, unless you're working on a boat all day or, there's obviously some use cases where these things, you're a Sherpa or something. getting rid of the sunglasses, like as sexy as they look, is an easy thing to do. So mitigating that's like one small thing you can mitigate. You can go outside about an hour after the sun comes up with no sunglasses. That's always a great thing to do. Same thing at sunset. I hate to just appeal to nature all the time, but if you're to look at really cheap, effective ways, those are definitely the ways. Obviously, setting some boundaries around your consumption of devices after dark is, there's nothing novel about that.
Yeah. Discipline is free.
So. Yeah. Discipline is free. Yeah. But I will say, dopamine addiction is real, and I'm certainly a victim of it. I think we all are. I'm surrounded by screens all day for work. I don't get as much outside time as I would like to, but one thing that I have noticed is since having these, if I'm using my phone before bed or watching TV or something like that, I'm far less interested in continuing that behavior for as long as I was, noticeably so, before wearing them. My phone is boring with these things on.
Yeah, you turned me on to something, Joe, a while back where you can adjust the settings. You can put a color filter on your phone and turn it red. Same idea there. It's difficult to deal with. You're just screw this thing. My girl insists on falling asleep to the TV. So when I get in bed, it's these, if I want to watch for a little while. And then, I've got some really nice eye shades that I put on that help me, when I go to sleep to kind of keep that light out. Replacing your bulbs is not that difficult. However, finding them is really difficult. When you go to Target or Home Depot or wherever to find incandescent bulbs, it's no easy task. I think those the easy things are, what we just documented there.
For sure. Well, and there are some vendors online that sell things. You can find any manner of red light bulbs on Amazon. The efficacy or, quality of which may be a little bit dubious. If you're buying a $15 bulb from China, who knows if it's any good? I don't. But they do also make replacement drop-in LED park cans. If you did want to replace all the lights in your house with ones that were a little more friendly,
I think of important note too is for these to be effective, they have to be orange. They sell some. My girlfriend bought several pairs just trying to appease me. and they were all bogus. You can look at blue print. And if it's blue, they don't work. And so a lot of these ones that are, clearer, a little more transparent, they're no good.
You know how I knew these were legit is I looked at the clock on my oven and I thought that my power had gone out to my range because I couldn't see the clock at all. On the issue of sunglasses, I have heard, and I don't know if there's any substance to this, that there is a correlation between not wearing sunglasses in a sunny environment and not getting a sunburn. And as a ginger, this is particularly pertinent to me. So tell me there's some truth to that, Griff, or am I deluded?
No, you're not far off there. So there's this idea that you can build a solar callus. The solar callus is built by getting exposure during that time when UVA and IR are particularly prevalent. So that time in the morning and that time in the evening. And again, without sunglasses, you need that in order to basically activate this POMC pathway, the pro-opioid melanocortin pathway. And if you build up that solar callus, there is a less potential of you burning. People have sworn by that. People also say that limiting their PUFA intake has something to do with that as well.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. And is that just anecdotal, or is there any research to back that up?
I think it's anecdotal, but it tracks. You know, if you have dysfunctional redox pathways, your redox is essentially like the wireless net. I mean, consider it like Verizon or whatever for your mitochondria. If those channels are dysfunctional, you are going to basically have slower electron transport chain. The buildup of these reactive oxygen species, and potentially a system that's more geared towards being inflamed than not.
Interesting. And well, I guess pivoting just slightly to an issue we were talking about earlier. Speaking of electrons, what is your take on grounding? Or more specifically, perhaps earth dicking, as we know you've popularized.
Well, I mean, it's there's a common belief that those electrons are another source of fuel for us. It's a kind of a, you know, typically we think of food as our fuel, but the free transfer of electrons, you know, making sure that we've got a properly lubed electron transport chain. I mean, that's key to metabolism. So again, not that there's like a lot of robust research to study this kind of stuff, because it's just the funds aren't really available for something like that to, you know, run randomized controlled trials. But in theory, in practicality, like it's something that is, you know, can be pretty effective.
My Instagram ads would beg to differ, man. They give me a lot of like, we gave someone grounding and they don't have cancer anymore and shit like that. I get that every day.
Sleep with our bed
every
sheets
day.
And you'll,
they want me to buy one of those pads.
Your dick will get bigger.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of charlatans in that space too. And, sure. And I think there's a lot of people selling, bogus equipment, because some of those, some of those like grounded bed sheets, it's like you have to plug into the wall. Like you need to like run it out to ground, mm-hmm. you know, like run it out of your window. So, I mean, I think there's, you know, again, kind of like with that, you know, varying degrees of quality with the red light panels, those that flicker and those that don't, mm-hmm. It's sort of a, you know, similar situation.
Sure.
But isn't your outlet in your house grounded if your house is properly grounded?
Yeah. Well, I was about to say that, but if it's pulling from that as opposed to the positive and negative, right?
Yeah, that's true. I guess I don't know.
Yeah, but it should be, it is grounded. Yes. If you have a 3-prong outlet, it's going into the ground.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It should be, but then you're, you know, what you've got going on in that at that point is, you know, are you, you know, what do you have in the way of magnetism that's surrounding you? That's, mm-hmm. you know, they think that then becomes another issue that kind of leads into the EMF thing.
For sure. Well, let's go there. I guess what role does magnetism play in this whole equation that we're talking about, which seems to center around the mitochondria predominantly?
Well, you know, electrons aren't just like a simple charged thing. I mean, they have varying degrees of energy associated with them. And we can certainly see when you subject, say, DNA to a magnetic field, certain torsional effects can be seen. So it stands to reason that surrounding yourself with Wi-Fi, with Bluetooth constantly has the potential to twist that DNA around a little bit.
Interesting. What effect would that have? Obviously not good.
I mean, it can, you know, all of the things that we've kind of been discussing. I mean, once all of this really breaks down, I mean, at the end of the day, most of the problems that are associated with aging, cancer, I mean, these are fundamentally mitochondrial dysfunction.
The right answer was X-Men superpowers, but I'll take that. I'll take that. You know, I'd be a lot cooler. It'd be a lot cooler if you said that, Griff.
Yeah, I wish. Maybe someday. Go ahead.
No, go.
Well, I was just going to say, like, what is what is NNEMF and how does it differ, I guess? Like, 'cause there's EMF in nature. So like, what are the different kinds and how do they?
So the non-native EMFs, you know, that would be the 5G, the wireless, the Bluetooth, you know, how the forces that they exhibit are maybe like a little outside of my purview. But they, again, just like light coming through a window is distorted. You know, these aren't typical magnetic fields that you would, you know, navigate a compass with. You know, these are high energy fields that you're constantly being subjected to.
And so if non-native EMF is bad for us and we're surrounded by it, I mean, in this room alone, we've got an iPad, two laptops, a desktop computer, a TV, whatever, Wi-Fi. How are we supposed to, like, you know, insulate ourselves from the negative effects of those things?
Well, I mean, you're doing a good job with wired headphones. I mean, nice. you're mitigating nice. Some of the damages that you would otherwise be seeing if you just had like your AirPods in. You know, some people will, there's a company several companies that make shirts and underwear that basically have like silver running through them that helps deflect that. This hat, you know, does the same thing. So, you know, there's a few things that you can do. I mean, turning off your Wi-Fi or your TV when you sleep is advised. Not everybody does it. Keeping your phone away from, you know, the bed. I mean, the nice thing about it is, for every foot that a device is away from you, it's on a logarithmic scale. So, for every foot that you remove that device from your body, you know, if you can get it 5-10 feet away, you know, effectively you're not getting the same impact as you would if you like have your phone in your pocket or like right by your bedside table.
Right. Mm. So maybe you don't have like a Wi-Fi booster in your bedroom or maybe.
Ideally, yeah. Turn it off at night. I mean, these are, you know, the EMF thing, I think, you know, again, it's one of those situations where it's like really hard to mitigate when you've got a partner, you know, like getting someone on board with that kind of thing. But if you're experiencing any kind of health issues, you're going to kind of, you know, begin checking things off the list. Mm. And if you've, you know, you've filtered your water, you're wearing your blue blockers, you know, you're eating a wholesome diet, like all this stuff, and you still have something persisting, then, I mean, EMF is probably, you know, EMF, air filtration, like those are probably some of the, you know, the later things that people will get to. But all of these things eventually kind of, you know, lead you to that. 'Cause I mean, while we focus so much on food and pharma as being the big, you know, deleterious health impacts, you know, I think we're kind of overlooking light and energy, as potential culprits.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree with that. And I'm really excited to see that there's just more interest in this stuff and more research going on around it. One of the things that, speaking of energy, I think we all have a particular interest in is nicotine. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. There's been a lot of, I would just say like influencers in the space, not just like, you know, the Zen bros, but people who are bringing to light, oh, like nicotine is a nootropic and it has all these potentially beneficial effects. How much of that is good information? How much of that is BS?
Nicotine's beneficial effects, I think, are capped at like 2 milligrams a day.
Damn it.
So the kind of like big problem I have with it is just the addictive nature of it. You know, like being so tethered to something. 'Cause, you know, I know plenty of people who didn't smoke their entire lives, never used nicotine, and now are crushing Zens and pouches. And, you know, the pouches are a little suspect because they all contain microcrystalline cellulose, which absolutely gets trapped in these junctions inside of your, you know, intestinal epithelial cells. And so that can ultimately impact molecular signaling across those junctions. And they're finding, you know, amongst, like, when they, you know, they do autopsies and look inside of people, they're finding all kinds finding things like seeds and plastics and all this kind of stuff. And microcrystalline cellulose is one of the things that is pretty commonly found in people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you're, you know, if you've got a pouch in from the moment you wake up until, I mean, some people fall asleep with them. You know, like that, you know, this is a situation where these things are so novel, that the long-term impacts of that, you know, it's not like an acute thing for most people.
Yeah.
I mean, anecdotally, like the peristalsis effect that you get from it, where it's, you know, you get a lot of hiccups, you know, that is the kind of thing that I feel like long-term is probably problematic. But yeah, I mean, they're irritating to the mucosal lining in the throat. They're addictive. You know, I tread lightly these days with it. But you know, it's 10:30 Eastern time, and like I've got a knickknack in because I want to be dialed for you.
Yeah. Appreciate you, buddy. Mm-hmm. Really compromising your long-term health for the good of this podcast. That's what we need around here, you know? A little sacrifice.
I mean, I wish I had like a, you know, better answer for you on that. But I mean, again, like with all the natural flavors and microcrystalline cellulose, and then some of these new pouches are, you know, I saw a mass spec done on the Alp pouch.
Tell me more.
It's the form of nicotine in it had some impurities. So I think, you know, as there's just more and more manufacturers pumping these things out, the quality of the inputs, you know, maybe at question.
I was kind of digging into them because I know there was a lot of buzz about them going around, no pun intended, that like Tucker was releasing a pouch brand and, or, you know, had something to do with it, was repping it. And I was like, oh, like hopefully it'll be better than, you know, the other ones in terms of quality ingredients and that sort of thing. And it appeared to me to be worse. There were more ingredients, some of them which seemed to be relatively suspect. Do you think, is there a gradient within the space of nicotine pouches? If somebody were to try to find the better one, is there one you think is better?
I mean, the knickknacks seem to be the cleanest. You know, I'm free of most of the garbage that's associated with it. You know, there's some suggestions that nicotine may have some positive impacts on, you know, on gut health. I think everything that I've seen is limited to the, you know, like a 2 milligram quantity. You know, and then if you're that low and maybe you're on the gum or something, well, then you've got, you know, some titanium dioxide that's making it white. You have these colorants, you know, you have these other chemicals that, again, like long-term, I mean, we're kind of the experimental group here for them. You know, it's just another way for big tobacco to kind of dig their claws into you. And it's, I mean, you know, like I said, the amount of people that are consuming these things that would never even touch nicotine before, I just think like philosophically, there's probably it's problematic to be so dependent on something.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, well, I'm the perfect example of that. Never smoked in my life. I mean, like once or twice, but, yeah, it's a different thing for sure. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well,
you
cool.
You use them, David?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every now and then.
Yep. Every now and then when we podcast, because we like to be on for you, Griff.
Yeah, man.
Hey.
I mean, you work security. Anything you can stay awake.
Totally.
Is good.
True. Yeah. I'd rather
drive
have
an
you...
Uber till 4 in the morning. Nicotine's your friend.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's kind of a necessary thing. But I enjoy them too.
There's some cool things like, I mean, caffeine's, you know, not too dissimilar. Yeah. Where like super easy to abuse. And really we're, you know, what we're seeking ultimately is just that hit of dopamine. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can get that with just like a hot beverage in the morning. You know, I've been drinking this stuff called Rare Bird. Have you heard of this?
I've not.
It's a decaf coffee. So coffee has like three active molecules in it: caffeine, paraxanthine, and theobromine. And the caffeine is, you know, that vasoconstricting molecule that like can give you, you know, raise your blood pressure and make you anxious. Paraxanthine kind of gives you all of the benefits of caffeine without those negative side effects. So I've been experimenting with that mixed with chicory, which has a inulin prebiotic fiber in it. And then a human milk oligosaccharide, basically like a sugar that's only found in breast milk. And that combo, I mean, I haven't drank coffee as a result of consuming that. And I haven't noticed anything, you know, I haven't missed it. So there's all these, there's different ways of getting that fix. You know, you can, I mean, a toothpick, you know, can sometimes scratch the itch. But yeah, I mean, removing yourself from the shackles of big tobacco is probably a wise move.
That checks out.
Yeah, sure.
Should we quit, David?
Not now. I got a legislative session to finish, brother.
Fair point. After the legislative session, we'll circle
Let's
back
do it.
With this. We'll have Griff back, and we'll talk about how to quit nicotine after the legislative session.
Sounds like a great time.
Griff, thank you for joining us, man. I don't know exactly where people can find you, but what would you prefer to send people to on the internet to keep up with you?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on X and Substack. At Better For Y'all. BetterForYall. So over there, I'm posting a lot of thoughts, and I'm about to release a kind of a four bucket framework for turning yourself into a citizen scientist and beginning to understand how you can transform your health through kind of guided experiments that I'm putting together. And hopefully that can kind of encompass the like I said, four buckets that I've found to be pretty impactful. You know, those being movement, cognitive fitness framework, your carbohydrate insulin management, you know, how you deal with your nutritional biochemistry, how you partition nutrients. So I'm working on that, and that'll be available on the website betterforyall.com as well as Substack. And yeah, I mean, those are probably the Substack X, probably the easiest way to hit me up.
Awesome. That sounds great. I appreciate that, because, you know, a lot of us out there, myself included, are kind of just going at this blindly and trusting our own anecdotal experience for if something works or doesn't work. Like the grounding sheets didn't seem to work. Red light glasses or blue light blocking glasses seem to work. So having some more a frame around that, I think, would be very helpful for myself and a lot of other people. So we'll be sure to put those notes down below the video and in the show notes on Spotify and everywhere else. John Griffith, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. It's great to have you.
Such a pleasure. Great to see y'all.
It's been a good time.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, comment below. Hit the notification bell.
All the things
we're supposed to say as YouTube and podcasters. We probably ought to say that at some point this podcast.
Don't forget to get your dopamine fix from our notifications.
Yeah. There we go.
Thanks for watching Human Reaction. We'll see you in the next one.
Peace.
Cheers, y'all.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
nicotine's beneficial effects, I think, are capped at like 2 milligrams a day.
Damn it.